This podcast is sponsored by the Center for International Business, Loyola University New Orleans College of Business.
Welcome to Gumbo of Opportunities, the podcast where we dive deep into the landscape of international business with a closer look at the state of Louisiana and New Orleans. We will hear stories, insights, and strategies of influential global players of the Bayou region in a pursuit to make the Bayou one of the most attractive areas for businesses. This is Gumbo of Opportunities.
Hello, everyone. Today we have a very nice and engaging episode, and we have almost a full room in our podcast studio, because today I'm joined with Gustavo Barbosa, that you know from our podcast, but also we have an esteemed guest today, Professor Marco Vivarelli from Catholic University of Milan, Italy. So I would like for my co-host and the guest to just say hello to our listener.
Perfect. Thank you, Alessandro. It's always a pleasure to be here in this podcast, a Gumbo of Opportunities, where we have the opportunity to engage in very productive conversations with leaders in the fields. In this case, we are honored to have Professor Vivarelli, all the way from Milan Cattolica, joining us in this wonderful conversation. So I think we're in for a very good treat. I think it's going to be a wonderful conversation, lots of insights. And so, Marco, welcome to Loyola.
Thanks, and thanks a lot. Very happy to be here. I hope we'll be productive. We will see. Thanks again.
We will absolutely be productive. I'm sure it's going to be a very great episode for everyone, for our students in particular, but for everyone interested in the topic that we are going to talk about today. Let me just introduce our guest of honor today. Marco Vivarelli is a full professor of economics at the Catholic University in Milan, where he also serves as the director of the Department of Economic Policy. Marco holds a PhD in Science and Technology Policy from the University of Sussex in the UK and another PhD in Economics from the University of Pavia in Italy. His research interests span the relationship between innovation, employment, and occupations, as well as the economic and social impacts of artificial intelligence. Marco has published extensively in prestigious international academic journals and has authored and edited several books. Just speaking from the long list of CV from Marco, is the editor-in-chief of the Eurasian Business Review. He's also a member of the Academia Europea and the European Academy of Sciences and Arts. He also serves as a scientific consultant for prestigious international organizations such as the International Labour Office, the World Bank, and the European Commission. All of this in Gumbo of Opportunities. Okay, hello everyone. Again, hello Gustavo and hello Marco that are joining us today. And we can start with the interview to Marco Vivarelli. Marco, I take the privilege to ask the first question. So, Marco, your research extensively focuses on the relationship between innovation and employment. In the context of all these rapid advances that we are experiencing, in particular in artificial intelligence, but also in automation, how do you see these advances, these technologies impacting the job markets in both developed and developing market? And if you see there is a difference between these two groups of countries?
Yeah, actually, as other kind of innovation, AI that is peculiar from some point of view, but it's not from this particular point of view. It's similar to previous innovation wave. Is characterized by different component. Some are complementary to jobs. Some others are substitution, actually. And this is connected with the double nature of AI. If we think about an AI algorithm, this is a product innovation. As a product innovation is a complementary to jobs. So for instance, is a company is in on the supply side and patenting and innovating in terms of AI algorithm, needs a computer scientist. And so you see the complementarity in between innovation and employment. But of course, when the algorithm or the robot is actually used, is adopted by downstream companies, you may have the labor-saving effect, the substitution effects. So the outcome in terms of labor market is a kind of the results of a matrix. You have to see whether you are on the product or process innovation side, and you see whether you are a supply industry or a user industry. And this is connecting with developing and developed countries. If, as a developing countries, I'm actually specialized in the user sectors, when I will receive the process innovation nature of these new technologies, that means that I will actually have a dominant role of labor saving and job losses kind of effect. If, on the other hand, I diversify into the supply sectors, so the provider of new technologies and the product innovation sides of the innovation wave, in this case, complementarity with new jobs and job creation is likely. So in terms of policy option is really the point in order to maximize the positive effect is actually targeting product innovation and emerging new sectors. Maybe the overall impact in terms of employment will not be so large, but positive. On the other hand, if you are locked in traditional sectors and you are just adopting robots, algorithms, AI devices, it's very likely that process innovation will be dominant and job destruction will be dominant. And so you need safety nets and policies to mitigate the negative impact in terms of jobs.
Mm-hmm. In particular, I guess it's in that specific example, the last example that you mentioned, in which we also see kind of a negative reaction by the society, by the actors in the society, because they see that actually AI may be perceived as something negative because it substitutes jobs to automation, right? So I guess it's the kind of a perverse effect that we need to avoid in a system that is looking for, you know, embracing technological advances.
Absolutely. The fear of technological unemployment is very spread around in the society, both in developed and developing countries. And it's partially justified. But of course, it depends the way how you produce and you adopt these technologies. So in a way, it's an open question. And of course, if you maximize, as I mentioned before, the job creation effect, you also maximize the social cohesion around the new technologies. If you are just leaving the market and doing the job, it could be the case that some of the fears actually realize in the societies and this is make difficult for the society to accept the new technology as such.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, correct. Now, as I hear you, you know, there's a lot of things that come to my mind, but one specifically, and that is the composition of the labor market in terms of the levels of human capital that might be, you know, available in different locations. And it appears, if I'm following the conversation, that AI may enhance productivity for people with high labor skills, but it might, you know, create labor-saving technologies and then displacing workers that don't have much on the human capital level. Is that a fair statement?
I think that this was surely true for the ICT technologies that were also named skill bias technologies, because they tended to be friends in a way of the higher skilled, the highly educated, and particularly adverse for manufacturing blue collars and low skills. Nowadays, this is partially true, but it's more complicated. Because actually, this kind of technology, they may also substitute cognitive skills, high skill. And on the other end, sometimes considered low-skilled jobs, like, for instance, caring of elderly people or nursing, they are relatively safe because they need personal relationships that cannot be fully done by a robot or an algorithm. So nowadays it's more complicated. Of course, the very the top creative and cognitive kind of skills are still preserved, but the middle skills, the middle high skills, in principle, they can be actually substituted, or at least some task within the occupation. That's often the case. The new technologies generally they can substitute some task within a given job, within a given occupation. So that doesn't mean that the worker loses jobs or her jobs, but has to deal with these new devices that can be complementary from some task, they can be substituted for others, and they can be actually, at least for the time being, not useful for other tasks. So now the situation is more nuanced. While it was clear in the past that upskilling was a strategy to avoid technological unemployment, now is more complex.
And more complex. That you know, that conversation leads us to the next question that we have prepared, and it reads something like this. AI has the potential to transform productivity patterns at most levels of human capital with a slight bias to higher levels. First part of the question, is this correct? And then a follow-up section of this question is, in this new paradigm, what are your thoughts regarding optimal firm size to achieve economies of scale as you know AI becomes a much more used form of a firm organization?
We already discussed the first point. The second point is extremely interesting and challenging because I think I see a kind of dichotomy in AI production and diffusion. Because on the one hand, innovation activity is open to younger and smaller firms. You may have a very smart PhD students gathering together and providing a new app for the smartphones or a new algorithm, or a relatively small software house inventing a new application of AI and an algorithm or a particular device. So in providing the new technology, I see a room for even for SMEs, small and medium enterprise. But then, in order to make the algorithms profitable, you have to feed the algorithms with big data. You need data to make the algorithm more precise and actually usable for profitable purposes. And here comes the role of the big tech. Mm-hmm. So you are on the other extremes. In order to feed the algorithms and to have the machine learning effects and to have the final product in terms of the potentialities of an algorithm, the AI device, you need the big data and the big tech. And that's peculiar to this kind of paradigm, because generally a new paradigm is starting with small firms and everything is up to the entrepreneurial sources and the entrepreneurial way of making innovation and production. This is true for providing software and algorithms, but when you need the data, you have the usual subset, mm-hmm. Meta, Amazon, the Chinese one, Alphabet, and so on and so forth. And that's a little bit dangerous in a way, because it means that this new paradigm is starting concentrated, and the power to make an algorithm profitable is up to the big tech. On top of that, many of these software house and entrepreneurial initiatives are actually bought by the big tech. Mm-hmm. Some of these young inventors, they actually start to develop an algorithm with the purpose to be actually to be acquired by a big tech. So what is apparently Schumpeterian, that was apparently competitive at the beginning, in the long term is going to the hands of a few actors. Correct. And this, of course, is challenging in terms of the market concentration, in terms of economic terms, but even in terms of the society as a whole, because mm-hmm. the power is there.
It occurs to me, you know, once again, one of the papers that I have read, and I think it was transformational in my education, was the George Akerlof, A Market for Lemons and the Presence of Information Asymmetries, changing the way we used to see markets from very competitive into asymmetric. Would it be fair to say that in this new way of business organization, first, we need to rethink how decisions are made, and what is more competition, more specialization, driving the decisions in the market, one. And two, high levels of concentration in a handful of firms you mentioned, the Google, the Meta, the Huawei, right, have the potentiality to further create information asymmetries. Would that be something that we should be concerned as more concentration of information happens within smaller number of firms, so that AI could actually spit out, you know, the optimal results that are seek in the big data? Is that something that you know, from business development perspective, we should be worried about?
I think so. Market asymmetries, information asymmetries have been always there. Even in the example you mentioned, there was an article in the 60s that was about the market of lemons, or the usual example is the used cars.
Used cars, yeah.
So even in a traditional kind of manufacturing selling, that there were asymmetries. Can you imagine how much asymmetries is created by this kind of monopoly mm-hmm. of the data and information that are up to the one that actually can collect and profile millions of individuals? So AI can be an accelerator of these asymmetries. And this, of course, calls for a regulation mm-hmm. in terms of law, in terms of kind of antitrust that should be more on information rather than on price and, mm-hmm. and market shares. We are in the U.S., so a new Sherman Act on information asymmetry is probably necessary nowadays.
Perfect. Thank you. Ale, please go.
Yeah, no, I would like to... not come back, but just to stress again this close relationship between technological advances, the use of AI, the integration of AI in businesses, and its relationship with the way job markets are changing, the way AI is reshaping the job market. I think it's also a very important topic to talk about, even for our podcast, because... as Gustavo can also discuss with me, and we discussed that in the podcast, as sometimes in the past, our College of Business is investing a lot of money and also a lot of brain power, manpower, in now trying to find the ways AI can support business decision and also to translate this knowledge to our students. So, Marco, my question for you regarding this relationship would be, from a policy-making point of view, what can be the strategies that policymakers, but also even educational institutions, so higher education, for example, should adopt to make sure that the workforce, even the new workforce, our graduates, are adequately prepared for the challenging and for the way the job markets are evolving right now?
What I see all around the university, even my university in US, is a kind of race to provide the new profession, that are considered complementary to the AI. So everywhere we are opening up courses in data scientists, software engineering, and so on and so forth. I think that is necessary, but I think it's not enough. Because, of course, you have to provide a workforce that has to be complement to the providing and to the developing of the new technologies. But this is a minority of the job job force, of the working force. And so, what about the rest? My feeling is that, given the role of AI in complementing or substituting even cognitive skills and specialized skills and technical skills, what is the value added that the human beings can provide in comparison of a robot or an algorithm? I think that is more on the general knowledge, creativity, not so much specialized, but wide range, broader kind of capabilities. So I would encourage also humanities, for instance, that are often neglected, but they could be actually the way to have a workforce that is open-minded, and so to provide that value added that cannot be provided by an algorithm or by a robot. So a balance in between some kind of profession that are directly complementary to AI detailing knowledge, and others that are more on general knowledge and general capabilities and the kind of a broader perspective in terms of what you are studying, what you are applying, and what you are doing as a manager, for instance, or in general terms as a worker. That's my feeling, but I'm not a pedagogist, so
again,
take with care.
you mentioned a topic that that is, of course, very timely and very important. You know, we both come from universities that are Catholic in its essence. And one of the main things that we want to teach our students is to educate the whole person and become people that can make, you know, just and ethical decisions and not solely rely on an algorithm that will give them two options and they choose from options that may not be ethical, may not be just, may not be reasonable, but they are an algorithm and they do spit out a potential choice. And so educating those students to be thoughtful in their process and understanding the implications of creating, you know, opportunities, creating potential decisions, and then choosing out of those is one of the challenges that we're facing, you know, at the university level, but also the College of Business. How can we best educate our students so that they are able and capable of using AI? Because it's coming to the classroom whether we want it or not. Students use it for papers. They use it for, you know, pretty much any decision, gathering data, literature reviews, you name it. There's too many tools out there. What has been your experience at Cattolica in Milan in terms of incorporating AI within the classroom and within the research that students conduct?
That's a very vast territory of trade-offs. That was always the case for technologies. I mean, technology can be used in a good way or in a bad way, can have a good impact or an adverse impact. It depends on the human beings. So there is an ethical issue that is often debated in my university as well. And there is also the the question mark about the instrument as such and the purpose you use for. Just to make a very, very basic example, as professor, we are irritated when we see an undergrad thesis or an essay that has been fully written by ChatGPT that is massively used by our students. So this is a way to use ChatGPT. Is an unethical way? Maybe not, because that is the tool. The tool is used. So again, what we have to ask our students is the value added. So you may summarize your concept with ChatGPT. You may use ChatGPT, but if we want creativity, if we want new ideas, if you want some kind of critical thinking, then ChatGPT is not enough. So to insist in critical thinking, even in business studies and economic studies, is important. So in principle, to have some kind of philosophy in our curriculum, it could be good. Because it is a way to open minds of our students and to train them to have a critical perspective on what they are doing. On the other hand, if we are too much technical and too much specialized and too much oriented to the details, this can be done by ChatGPT. And so, again, as in the past, it depends on us how to divert the attention and also our requirements to the most critical and creative part of the discussion, the issues, the topics. And that's the only way to preserve the genuine creativity of our students, but probably also of our teaching.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you, Marco, because so far we, in particular, thanks to also the question by Gustavo, we discussed about the supply side of the educational market in terms of adoption of AI, in terms of how to use AI appropriately, ethically, and effectively as well, of course. Now, I have a final question, which focuses more on the demand side of what we do. So focuses on students. And we always like to close each episode of the podcast once we interview special guests, asking them about a question that directly relates to students. So my question would be, again, looking back to these specific challenges that students face today, also opportunities that they have today in terms of AI and so on, if you have to speak to recent graduates, people, young people entering the job market right now, what suggestion would you give them on how to stay updated on the, you know, on the way job market is changing, in particular, thanks or because of AI? And what step can you suggest them? What step should they take, actually, to continuously deepen and develop their skills? Because earlier you talk about soft skills, which cannot be complemented, which cannot be substituted by AI. So what are the steps that they should take to keep developing their soft skills?
And then this is connected with what discussed in previous question. There are two sides. On the one hand, you need to be familiar with the new technologies. So, for instance, again, universities are now providing courses in order to make the right prompts to ChatGPT in order to have the answer you need. So you have to get familiar, and you have to learn that you have to ask precise questions, you have to make ChatGPT in the right context in order to have a useful answer. So that's on the left hand. On the other hand, on the right hand, again, you have to make stronger the overall general knowledge and the critical thinking. This is connected with what I said before. In order to have ChatGPT as a tool, as a support of something that should be an higher level, should be an upper level in terms of general vision. And that's what is generally lacking, actually, in maybe also in our teaching or in our students, that is the vision. So an attention to the technical details, including the ChatGPT prompt or other issues that are necessary, but again, are not enough. If not, they are not coupled with a general vision that can make the difference. And my guess is that in the futures, better manager, better policymakers, better professor will be the one able to keep creativity and general knowledge and a vision in order to do something more than what can be done by ChatGPT. So in order to make this kind of knowledge stronger, this of course has to be updated continuously, but has to be preserved this kind of the right hand, the second perspective that is the more general one. And my perception is that actually university, the administration, even ourselves, maybe we insist too much on the left hand, the technical stuff and the technicalities, and not enough about the vision. And that's my suggestion, actually.
Excellent. Yeah. You know, as I hear you speaking, it reminds me this very old saying that a half the answer of a math problem is a well-understood question. And it's the issue of, do I know what I'm asking? What is it that I need from the system to give me? And giving that capability to our students to be able to know what they need to ask, I think it goes back to having those courses where they need to really think. They need to get the philosophy. They need to get the theology. They need to get the moral courses. They need to get the theory. They need to get the math. I'd like to give my students the perspective of when they see a person playing a sport, right, say a soccer player or a football player, they never see them with weights or, you know, doing exercises. They see them on the field. But in able to make those plays that they make, they spend a tremendous amount of time doing weightlifting, doing a good diet, doing all these very important components of the performance that we don't get to see in the education process. That is what happens in the classroom when they are able to interact on a one-to-one with the faculty, and then we're able to tell them how to think and then sort out what used to be our problem. We did not have enough information. Now they have the opposite problem. They have way too much information. And sorting that information becomes a real challenge for the students. And so your remarks are spot on the challenges that we're facing here as well, that are now not just specific to one university in one region. These are across the border, across programs. And so your remarks are definitely very well taken for, you know, and I'm speaking on behalf of our students and our faculty. So we thank you for those remarks.
Yeah.
I think that probably for our students, the two key words are consciousness and awareness. To be aware of what they are asking to ChatGPT or AI devices, to be aware that they have to have a vision to contextualize what they are actually making with the help of AI, and never forget to be fully conscious and aware of the entire process. I think that, yeah, this is the perspective we should suggest to them, particularly in the Catholic education, where we know that we are dealing with a fully fledged person, and we have to preserve the entire and the fully fledged aspect of a personality.
Yes,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think it's been a great travel towards, you know, the world of AI, towards the direction that we are all taking towards embracing this new paradigm. And I'm sure this topic will be picked up by Gamble of Opportunities again in the future. So I want to remind our listeners to make suggestions, comment, give us a feedback about what you think. Did you like the episode? Did you have something to add to the discourse? Because it's a very up-to-date and engaging discourse, that one that you are developing. So follow us on social media, like usual. Leave a comment, subscribe, and follow us for future episodes of Gamble of Opportunities. Thank you so much, Gustavo, for co-hosting this episode with me.
Thank you so much, Alessandro. For me, it's always a pleasure to be here. I want to thank you for, you know, always being a leader in this process. I want to thank Marco, Professor Vivarelli, for being here with us today. We are honored with your presence and your remarks, and Loyola is your home. Anytime that you want to come back, we will welcome you. And so thank you so much for your remarks. Thank you so much to the listeners and all the sponsors. We want to thank the Reynolds family for their financial support, making all this possible. And on behalf of the Center for International Business and the Center of Entrepreneurship and the Gamble of Opportunities, this has been a wonderful conversation. And we're looking forward to your comments in the next podcast. Thank you.
Thanks so much. It was a really pleasure. And thank you to the listener as well. And yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Gamble of Opportunities, the podcast about international business of Southern Louisiana and New Orleans. Huge thanks to Farah, Oban, and all the staff involved for making this podcast possible. The music is New Orleans Jazz Guitar Music by The Music Hive.